Hello once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Thursday, August 10th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so. We're going to cover all kinds of things in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here for what I like to call the Thursday meeting show. Generally, during the season, we're going to be joined by both Brad Powers and Rolf Michaels. Rolf Michaels unable to join us today, so we're just going to go ahead and do a full hour with Brad Powers from bradpowersports.com. Brilliant, brilliant college football handicapper. Really excited to get another season going with him here on today's show. Before I do that, a few things I want to bring to your attention. The first, we've had a lot of positive feedback here in terms of our call for writers. I've been communicating with several different people on Twitter. If you're still interested in possibly doing some writing for us over at bangthebook.com, please hit me up on Twitter at @skatingtripods. Those that are listening to the show regularly know I'm getting married tomorrow, so it may be kind of tough for me to get back to you this weekend, but I will certainly get back to everybody in as timely of a fashion as I possibly can. Second thing I want to mention here, talked about this a little bit throughout the week, but ways to get Bang the Book Radio. Full shows at bangthebook.com, also Blog Talk Radio, and on iTunes. Segments, bangthebook.com and Spreaker. So if you only have time to listen to one guest, or you're only interested in listening to one guest when we have some different topics here on the show, you can get those segments over on our Spreaker page and then also over at bangthebook.com. Got little clips and descriptions for those types of things. Also, please keep sending us that feedback about our audio quality. Yesterday's show fully recorded before the live version. Today's show fully recorded as well. So I've had a chance to edit those for sound. Go back and listen to Tuesday's show. Compare and contrast. Let us know what you think about the sound differences between the two shows. Finally, tons of stuff going on over at bangthebook.com. Play those contests that we have. Check out all of our preseason college football write-ups. We're working on some NFL stuff as well. We've got everything that you need. We are your one-stop shop for sports betting news and information. This edition of Bang the Book Radio and all editions of Bang the Book Radio presented proudly by DSI Sportsbook. If you head on over to DSI Sportsbook, use the promo code BTB and the number 25. It's good for a $25 free bet just for signing up. So you can test drive the site, see if you like the interface, see if you like the customer service, if you need to talk to them, something like that. And then if you do decide to deposit, you'll get a 100% deposit bonus based on the amount of that deposit. And then also, if you decide to do something at the live casino, you get a 100% deposit bonus over there as well. So our good friends over at DSI Sportsbook taking very, very good care of you here as you look for some new outs for the college football and the NFL seasons. Without further ado, we'll bring on today's one and only guest. That is the great Brad Powers from bradpowersports.com. Bradley, how's it going today, brother? How are you?
It's going well on a fine, beautiful Thursday morning, Adam. And, you know, I got to say right off the top, congrats on your big day coming up tomorrow, bud. Long waited. I know you've been with her for a while, and just want to throw my congrats out there to you.
Thank you very much, sir. Really, really appreciate that. I'm very lucky. I mean, you've gotten a chance to hang out with her a couple times in Vegas, and, you know, I think you know how lucky I am, too. So really, really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you outkicked your coverage, Adam, a little bit there. So,
let's be honest, my coverage doesn't go all that far anyway, so it wasn't too difficult for me to do that. All right, brother, we got a ton of stuff to get to here on today's show, and you know, one of the things I've been talking about with the guests that I've had on, and I think this is something you and I touched on a little bit during the Tuesday Takeover show over the summer, but it's not a bad thing to touch on here. We talk about the accelerated timelines for college football. We talk about CG Technology, South Point coming out with win totals very early once again here this year, South Point coming out with all of them, CG coming out with, you know, some of the chosen few Power 5 conference types of teams. Then you get games of the year lines out. So you've had to have your numbers out very, very early again, and then now you're just kind of sitting on them. Do you sort of get a little bit concerned that maybe you can overanalyze some things during what's a little bit of a dead period for the college football prep season?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. You know, I went full bore, obviously, spring practice, watched a bunch of spring games, and, you know, had to dive completely into the teams like you so eloquently put there. I mean, CGT had season win totals up mid-May, and then South Point came out games of the year week one and season win totals on all 130 teams by Memorial Day weekend. So, I mean, I had to be fully prepped by that point to take advantage of some soft lines. And I got to be honest with you, what I did then is just completely, after I went through everything there, I took a break. I did not look and try to overanalyze college football teams. Did not even dive too much into the media days during the college football dog days of summer. I pretty much dropped it as far as following it on a full-time basis for about 6 weeks. I took a vacation and, you know, looked at it because, you know, I think you're exactly right. You can start overanalyzing teams. Now, once the calendar turned to the end of July, camp started opening up, and obviously everyone's in camp now entering their second week. I've jumped right back into the teams. It's been a couple of months since I gone over all the teams. I'm going over it again with a fine-tooth comb. I didn't want to be going over them 3-4 times. I only wanted to do it a couple of times, but I'm right back to kind of where I was, you know, post-spring practice with a lot of these teams. And I got to be honest with you, some teams I'm liking more than what I did at the end of spring. Some teams not so much, but what I'm in the process right now is going through every single team, every single position, and kind of doing like an up-down, and obviously taking into consideration what I'm reading in the fall practices. And look, in today's day and age, college football, I mean, we got kids transferring left and right, suspensions, you name it. It's tough to hide a lot of those things compared to 15 or 20 years ago. So I'm tweaking my numbers as we go here, Adam.
I do want to ask you about this, you know, because I think a fair number of our listeners, and our listener counts do back this up as well, you know, they play football, they play basketball, and then over the summer they're doing things, their kids are out of school, they don't really care too much about handicapping baseball. It's a money line sport, so it's a little bit different of an animal, that type of thing. So I imagine a lot of people are kind of in this same boat with you where, you know, the summer is a prep period, the summer is a chance to catch their breath, to take a little bit of a break. What do you do in terms of getting back into it? Do you hit the ground running, or do you kind of, you know, ramp up, almost like if you took a break from training, getting ready for a season, something like that as an athlete, you know, do you kind of go in stages a little bit, maybe do 4 hours a day, then six, then eight, you know, and then go to your usual 12 to 14 because you're just an animal like that? Or do you just hit the ground running and go right back into your normal routine?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I try to hit the ground running, although the body's not used to it. I had a day a couple days ago where I was grinding for like 12 hours straight, and I got to be honest with you, I went right to bed and ended up sleeping for 12 hours because, look, you're not digging ditches. It's not physical, but the mental aspect of this particular industry, it can be quite, I would say, it could be, either exhausting depending on what you're doing, especially if you're crunching numbers like I am at this point, staring at a computer screen and doing numbers for 12 straight hours. It can be exhausting, but it's a little bit of both. I mean, I really do try to hit as soon as late July hits to really start getting into the 10, 12, 14-hour day weeks because, I mean, you just have to. Preseason starting, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, later in the show here. And all of fall camps, I mean, there is a lot of material to digest when you got all 130 teams in camp. And that not everyone catches every single minute injuries. You would like to think the ESPNs and a lot of the other places like to catch it, but the reality is, they focus mainly on the Power Five, and you got to do the old school digging on the Group of Five schools, looking at local newspapers as far as trying to get some information out of those practices.
One of the things we've been talking about with our guests here throughout the week is power ratings. And, you know, power ratings are very important. They're a foundation of your handicapping. Now, I had a listener question about incorporating advanced analytics and how to do that into power ratings because, you know, a lot of the power ratings discussion we have on this show centers around rating the position groups, adding all that together, getting a power rating. Then, of course, from there, you apply home field advantage, all that type of stuff to come up with a spread. Now, I know that you do positional power ratings, but you have several sets of power ratings that you do over there. And what I told the listener was, you know, if you want to incorporate advanced analytics, you can either do that in the position groups, you know, and sort of rate them a little bit differently, or you can just come up with a second set of power ratings and then determine how you want to weigh that against the other set of power ratings that you have. So like I said, I know you have multiple sets. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of, you know, the differences between those sets and then how you weight them?
Yeah, first off, you know, as far as the advanced metrics go, I first and foremost put that right in the position group, whatever that advanced metric might be, you know, efficiency, defense, offense, all of those get right graded right in appropriately to the appropriate position group when I'm doing an up-down. And look, I know when you're coming up with a power rating, you're supposed to take the individual groups and then give a power rating and then come up with a combined. I got to tell you, I don't think most do when it comes to college football because there's 130 teams. And if we're talking 7, 8, 9, 10 position groups, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of work. And if you're still handicapping baseball, I tip my cap to anyone that can do that. But what I actually have is an entirely different set. Now, is it advanced metrics? You know, I don't know, but what I call it, the intangible section. And in that particular section, I'm looking at stuff like, you know, yards per point, yards per play, you know, what the schedule for the upcoming season. Does it get weaker? Does it get stronger? You know, last year, how did they fare in close wins and close games? Did they win a bunch of games by a touchdown or less? Did they lose a bunch? I'm looking at turnovers. You know, how much did they lose in the NFL draft compared to what they did from the year before? How many starts did they lose to injury from last year? Maybe they were banged up and, you know, lost four or five starters for the entire season. You know, what were they, you know, last year, did they have an outlier season, whether it be good or bad? I have this whole, probably I factor in 10 to 15 different categories that come with the intangibles. I weigh it more heavily than any other position group. And it's right factored into my position by position ratings, but I actually weighed the intangibles more heavily than any other position, including the quarterback.
Now, in talking to odds makers and bookmakers that are out there, and, you know, this is a luxury that you have. You're coming up on, I believe, your second full season out there in Las Vegas handicapping college football and being in the sports books and having this network and talking to everybody. When it comes to the shops, you know, the odds makers, do they mostly just go off of positional power ratings, or do they even come up with their own? Do they use Sagarin or, you know, Steel or something like that? How do you think that they do it? Have you talked to any of them about that?
You know, I know Chris Andrews comes out with it. He's probably a little bit more, willing to go out there with his own power ratings compared to everybody else. When it comes to the sports books, I mean, it's well known. I mean, one guy comes out with them, and it's, copy and paste for a lot of the other ones. That's just kind of what the industry that we live in. So, you know, I always tip my cap to the guys that are first, and obviously Andrews, and even, you know, to a lesser extent, CGT, when they came out with their 40-season win totals in the Power 5 teams. And what I see is, you know, they let the market take care of themselves, and then everyone else opens it up, you know, a couple months later. Some do, and I would say some probably rely, you know, even on your popular preseason magazine, like a Phil Steele publishes all of his power ratings, at least a couple of them, of his 9 sets that he has. And there's a couple other, guys out there, like a Bill Connolly from SB Nation that has his S&P factors. I'm sure a lot of people incorporate a lot of that into it. I know I do a little bit to mine. I obviously have my own personal feelings on each and every team, but I'd be remiss if I don't factor that in, because I think the rest of the entire market at least does that. At least the people that are doing it early and the guys that really focus in on the college football on a year-round basis like myself. But I hate to say it, and I don't want to disrespect any guys out there, but I would say more than half the books pretty much follow the leader and watch the market, what it does those first couple weeks, some sharps betting into those early release times as far as Memorial Day weekend, and then they just go from there as far as coming up with their own personal number.
In terms of now being out there in Vegas and becoming more of a bettor, this is something that we talked about last year and something that I'll touch on with you again here sporadically throughout this year. You've always been a handicapper. When you were working for North Coast and Phil Steele, you were breaking down teams, you were looking at, position groups and all that type of thing. Now you've had to become a bettor, and it's a much, much different animal to, go out there and follow along with the market, catch the market at the right times, know where numbers are going to go. Then, of course, obviously allocate your bankroll resources properly. And I'm sure you've done some more things with derivative betting now that you've been out there, and also the futures market and props and stuff like that. So has that forced you to make any changes to the way that you set your power ratings up?
No, not necessarily. I still set up my power ratings the same as always. I was very happy with my power ratings last year. They actually were probably more spot on than my own personal handicapping. Yeah, I was completely frank with everyone last year. It was a struggle going from, predominantly 100% handicapper, just betting your 5-7 games a week like I was doing for so many years, to increasing that probably fivefold, and it might even be tenfold this year, where I might have 50 bets or more in a particular football week, getting ahead of line moves on Sunday, playing back, And obviously when I'm covering 130 teams, sides and totals, and in-game live running, at least 50 bets I would put as an estimate. I can tell you I'm a lot more comfortable now, a year into it. But as far as, you know, coming up with a power rating, I still believe in the Phil Steele method. Look, there's a reason why he's been around for a couple of decades. I believe what I've been taught there. I think I have a pretty solid set of power ratings. I already feel very comfortable with it because, you know, as far as my own personal power ratings, you know, 5 or 6 of the max bets that I have out on week one, they've all moved a touchdown in the direction of where my power ratings are currently and where I perceive there to be value. So now, until I don't see the market moving in the direction of where my power ratings are and really moving in that direction, I don't think I need to tweak it too much, Adam. I think I have a pretty solid handle on how to evaluate teams in the off season. Where I have to tweak things and where I have to do a better time management is what you said there, you know, balancing the handicapping aspect, because let's face it, I can't give out 50 plays a week just because I'm betting them. I can't give out all 50 plays, especially with the in-game live running. Makes it very difficult, and balancing that from me becoming more and more predominantly of a bettor.
All right, well, one of the things that we've done here throughout the week is look at some specific teams that may be kind of difficult to power rate, teams that have new coaches with good talent bases, have new coaches without good talent bases, some teams that are going to a second year with a new head coach, all those types of things where, you know, you expect improvement or you expect a downgrade. Should you incorporate that into your power ratings? I think the best way to explain this here is to just talk about some of these teams. And the first team that I want to start with here with you, Brad, is Clemson. Clemson is a team that now all of a sudden is a premier program in college football. Back-to-back 14-1 seasons, national championship victory for them last year. 2 years ago, they were the runner-up. They've won at least 10 games every year since 2011. So they've reached that level now where it certainly feels like they're kind of more of a reload than a rebuild type of team. Is that a sentiment that you agree with?
Yeah, I would say so. And I would say I'm a little bit higher than the markets on Clemson this year. I get it. They lose arguably the best player in the history of the school in Deshaun Watson, lose their leading rusher, Wayne Gallman, lose an outstanding wide receiver, top 10 draft pick in Mike Williams. But what I do like about them is at the line of scrimmage, you know, the offensive line is one of the better ones in the country. I'd rate them in the top 10 as far as my positional ratings. They got 83 career starts back. And then, you know, the defensive line, I'd probably rank number 2 behind Ohio State in the country. A lot of people don't look at the line of scrimmage. They like to, you know, gloss over that factor. But I think Clemson, you know, has one of the best offense and defensive line combos out of any team in the country. And that's a pretty good start when you got relatively inexperienced skill positions. You know, I am concerned because it kind of does remind me of the 2014 season where they, you know, they lost a multiple-year starting quarterback in Taj Boyd. They had a young hotshot by the name of Deshaun Watson, but he wasn't quite ready yet. It's kind of the same this year. They got Kelly Bryant, a guy who's been in the program a couple of years. Hunter Johnson was the top-rated quarterback coming out of high school. He was in for spring. I don't know if he's going to be ready. And they got two really tough games in week 2 and week 3 against Auburn and Louisville. You know, you looked at the 2014 season, they were crushed by Georgia in the opener. And they also had a road trip to Florida State where they lost in overtime. I could see this Clemson team losing, you know, to Auburn and Louisville, maybe even both. The pick them against Louisville, they're currently favored against Auburn. And then maybe I'm buying this team by the end of the season once the quarterback situation and they get some more reps in there and they settle it down. Overall, I'm a firm believer in Dabo Swinney. This program is not going anywhere. He's built it to the point, and I would say no other coach right now in the country gets more out of his talent base than Dabo Swinney. He's not in the top 5 recruiting every year, unlike the Urban Meyers and the Nick Sabans, but yet you look at his postseason success the last 5 years, beating Urban Meyer twice, nearly beating Nick Saban twice, beat Bob Stoops twice, beat Les Miles twice. If you're expecting Clemson to lose 3-4 games, I think that's a bad bet. I think this is a 10-2 caliber team, and they'll be very, very good by the end of the season. And I would not be shocked if they even because they can lose to Auburn, obviously, maybe even Louisville if they own the tiebreaker over Florida State at the end, and they could take home another ACC crown.
In terms of looking at Clemson from where they were last year after winning the national championship game to where you have them now, how big of an adjustment is that in your power ratings?
Oh, I got him down probably about a touchdown. I think currently about 5 points, 5 to 6 points down. And mainly Deshaun Watson's probably worth the 5 or 6 points there at the quarterback. He's that good. I'm not necessarily concerned. I think they got some solid replacements at running back. You know, Gallman was a little bit of a disappointment last year. I do worry about the loss of Mike Williams is probably just as big as Deshaun Watson. Those two players alone, they probably have them down 5 points. But, you know, I got the up arrows at the offensive line, at the defensive line. I think they're pretty much set at linebacker, defensive backs. I don't mind the experience level there. I still would have favored, even after that game was played last year, I still would have had Alabama in hindsight as a slight favorite, obviously not by a touchdown, but I would have still had Alabama probably 2.5, 3 points as a favorite. Even after the game was played, if that makes any sense, I would have done the adjustment there. As far as my power ranks, I got Clemson right around number 5 or number 6. Looking at some of the markets and at least some of the other handicappers, I mean, a lot of people have, you know, bottom half of the top 10, where I'm, you know, I still think they're a borderline top 5 team, Adam.
And one thing for our listeners that are trying to construct power ratings and are maybe looking to do this for the first season, you know, Brad mentioned Deshaun Watson probably being 5 or 6 points down. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that if you're doing the position breakdown and you say you have a 5 to 15 scale at quarterback, that doesn't mean you're going to go from 15 at quarterback to 9 at quarterback. It means that you may go 15 to 12 or 12 and a half. You're going to downgrade the running backs because, you know, obviously the threat of Deshaun Watson throwing the football drops them down a little bit. Deshaun Watson was also very mobile, so he kept the team out of sacks, so that lowers the offensive line a little bit, and then obviously the wide receivers as well. Then you factor in, like Brad was saying, you lose Wayne Gallman, you lose Mike Williams, you know, then you already have a little bit of a downgrade there, the running back and the wide receiver position. So it's not like you want to change the position group from a 15 to a 9. You're just going to make subtle downgrades all across the offense, right, Brad?
Exactly. And the biggest, unless it's a huge adjustment, the biggest adjustment I do for an individual position is 3. I go anywhere from -3 to +3 at each and every position. So you're exactly right. You don't want to downgrade 6 full points there. I think you really set it up there that, you know, the loss of Deshaun Watson affects multiple position groups. So that is the rare instance where, you know, a guy can be worth, you know, a 5 or 6 points. But for his individual position group, no, I just have Clemson down, you know, the full 3. And that's usually my max downgrade for, you know, a team like that losing arguably the best player in the history of the school.
Last thing I want to ask you about with Clemson here. You mentioned they've got Kelly Bryant, who's been in the system for 2 years. He knows the offense. He was just sitting behind some guy named Deshaun Watson. Then you've got Hunter Johnson, the true freshman. In terms of your power ratings, Brad, is there a difference between the two if, let's say, Johnson does get the nod to start, or let's say Bryant struggles out of the gate? Is there a difference, or are those two pretty comparable right now? Because you've got the higher upside in Johnson, but the more experience in Bryant.
Yeah, and here's one thing I learned from being at Phil, where we actually had an individual player unit, a player grade on every single player on every single team. Obviously, Johnson comes in to the program with a higher overall rating coming out of high school than Kelly Bryant, but the fact that Bryant's been there a couple of years, you got to, once you're in a program, you got to actually adjust it. And look, I don't go into this because it took 20-25 employees to adjust every single player grade on every single team, but you know, just to, you know, from me knowing that, you know, Kelly Bryant would have, you know, moved, let's just say a half, for example purposes, a half point by being in the program a year, another half point for being in the program for 2 years. That would kind of make up for the difference for Hunter Johnson. Right now, I would say they're both comparable. You know, Hunter Johnson, you know, once he gets some snaps and he's with the program a full year, then obviously I think he's going to be the starter by the end of the season. He would have a higher player grade then at that point than Kelly Bryant. But right now, they're comparable. No matter who starts at quarterback, I'm not doing, at least at this point, an adjustment on Clemson until I see how they fare in actual game action for the both of them. Neither one looked that great in the spring game, although I got to throw this out there. Clemson probably had the most physical spring game of the 40 or the 50 that I watched. They were full live tackling on their quarterbacks, and that kind of tells you how much depth this team has. And Dabble says this is one of his deepest teams he's had. So I just want to throw that out there. That was made a pretty valid point there during spring, and that was a very physical spring practice. And the quarterbacks didn't handle it too well. We'll see what happens, you know, now that it's 4 or 5 months after that.
All right, we'll move to the SEC here. Let's talk about Texas A&M. Texas A&M has been a very, very difficult team for me to rate basically ever since they joined the SEC West. It's hard to be in a conference or in a division, I should say, with Alabama, LSU. You know, we had Auburn a couple years ago that was very good, and it certainly looks like Auburn going to get back to being one of the stronger teams in the SEC here this season. But they're the only SEC school in Texas. And if you want to play SEC football, you're going to Texas A&M. So they recruit extremely well every single year, and they have all these highly touted quarterbacks that come in and out of this program. None of them seem to have been a good fit ever since Johnny Manziel. They've got an inexperienced quarterback again this year, but it's the second year of the Noel Mazzoni offense. Last year, 0.8 yards per play more than the previous season. So did you have a hard time with Texas A&M, or is this a team that you feel like you got a pretty good pulse for?
Yeah, I got a hard time, and I'm actually thankful that they're playing UCLA, another team that I expect to be improved. I know we're going to talk about them here in a little bit. Hard time because, you know, I think a lot of the improvements on offense, you know, might have been just, you know, Trevor Knight. It wasn't great by any stretch, but I thought that was a significant improvement from what they had the year prior. You know, he was deceptively mobile, had 10 rushing touchdowns over 600 yards, and was relatively, when he was healthy, efficient. And throwing the football, 19 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. So, you know, some of it was Mazzoni, but I thought some of it was just the upgrade that they had at the quarterback spot compared to what they had the year prior. That's a worry for me because this is another team that I watched the spring practice, and I did not come away overly impressed by Nick Starkel or the true freshman Kellen Mond, who's probably got far more upside, but again, a guy that was in for spring, and he's not a big guy, and I would be very concerned with Kellen Mond's ability to last a full season as a true freshman as a starting quarterback. He only weighs about 200 pounds, soaking wet, unless he's put on some pounds here coming into fall practice. I got my concerns. Look, I know the athletic director threw down the gauntlet and says we better win more than 8 games. I'll tell you what, if Kevin Sumlin wins 8 games this year, Adam, I actually think it'll be one of his better coaching jobs, probably his best one since 2012, because, I mean, let's just break it down. They lose their quarterback. They lose their top leading receiver. Christian Kirk is one of the better receivers in the country. Lose their top two tacklers, and they lose the number one overall draft pick in, obviously, Myles Garrett. They lose the other guy that was opposite him and Deshaun Hall. It's a relatively tough schedule, road trips to UCLA. They're at Florida, they're at Mississippi, they're at LSU, they'll be an underdog at home against Auburn, they're a double-digit underdog at home against Alabama. I think it's another 8-win type of season for them, and if that leads to Kevin Sumlin losing his job, I think that would be kind of a little bit of a mistake there. I know they've had some top 10 recruiting classes there, but it is the SEC West, and is that at least, you know, for the last 5 years has been the toughest division in college football. And that now I'm starting to, you know, feel that, you know, the ACC with Clemson and Florida State and Louisville in one division, and obviously the Big Ten East with Penn State, Michigan, and Ohio State's catching the SEC West. But it's a tough division. I think the worst thing to ever happen to them was them winning 11 games right out of the gate first year of the SEC. Unrealistic expectations. I think he's done a decent job. You would like him to be a little bit better performances in November than what they've had here. Now, I'm not a big fan of this year's talent level, and it starts at quarterback. You know, I downgraded that unit about 1.5 points. So the bright side is we'll know what we have with Texas A&M with the opener. That's why I love teams playing, comparable teams playing one another in the opener. I'll get a much better idea. I am not involved in a Texas A&M bet, whether it be season win total, but whether it be week one. I do not have a ticket on them just because I still have some questions and concerns.
Well, and that's the hard part because, you know, with your background, you're doing a lot in terms of looking at recruiting classes. And like you said, you have those individual player grades and all that. And Texas A&M is one of those programs that gets a lot of top 10 recruits at certain positions. They've had a lot of skilled players that are very, very highly touted. And this is a team that, you know, look, 8-5 playing in the SEC West is pretty damn good, really, when you think about it. But with the hype that comes with some of these kids and the hype that comes with some of the quarterbacks that they've brought in, you know, it hasn't been good enough. So do you feel like there does come that year with Texas A&M where they do actually live up to that talent level? And if so, is it something that probably happens without Kevin Sumlin?
You know, I could. You know, Kevin Sumlin's a good coach. You know, I really, you know, when people say he's, you know, below average, I mean, he has one at least. And this was a program that it's not like he inherited, you know, the early 90s Texas A&M team that was winning the Southwest Conference every year with Bob Davies, their defensive coordinator, and they had one of the Wrecking Crew defense. He inherited a program that was mightily struggling in the Big 12 and only topped, you know, in the previous 5 years before he took over, only topped, you know, seven wins one time in 2010. So he's definitely upgraded the recruiting talent level. He's upgraded the record. Has he gotten the most out of his players? No, outside of the first season with Johnny Football, it's been a little bit of a disappointment. Maybe they take that next step after he's gone, but realistically, what is the next step for Texas A&M? I know they had a lot of success there in the early 90s, but it's not like they were winning national championships. They were getting dominated in bowl games by Notre Dame and Florida State, losing a lot of those Cotton Bowls. They've never been the program that's been a consistent top 10 level outside of those years. I mean, some fan bases, I get it. Everybody wants to win the title. And in the SEC, when you're playing the Alabamas and the Floridas and the LSUs and Auburns, all teams that have won the title, I mean, sometimes you just got to know your role and stay in your lane in college football and really have some realistic expectations. And if you're expecting Texas A&M to be an 11, 12-win type of team with Alabama, until Nick Saban leaves, I just don't think that's realistic. I think if Texas A&M goes 8-5 this year and they don't completely collapse in the month of November like they have been, if I'm the athletic director, Kevin Sumlin's back for me at least in 2018.
I'll tell you what, we talked about Tulsa on yesterday's show with Sports Cheetah, somebody that I know you compare notes with, and we talked about Philip Montgomery and how good of a head coach he is, how great of a job he's done at Tulsa. Man, that seems like a pretty logical fit at Texas A&M if Kevin Sumlin gets canned, right?
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, keep in mind, everyone looks good at a lot of these Group of Five programs. Kevin Sumlin looked very good, had Houston one game short of making a BCS game there, had them undefeated. They lost to Larry Fedora and Southern Miss in a Conference USA championship game. Look, he looked awfully good in those lower-level conferences, too, until, you know, he got into the grind of the SEC. I get it. He would be a perfect fit offensively based. But, you know, if I'm Texas A&M, I went that way here with Kevin Sumlin. I get it. The Texas high school recruiting scene is a natural fit for that type of offense. But, you know, offense outside of, you know, quarterback with Johnny Football, you know, it hasn't been overly great. But the thing that's held Texas A&M back is the physicality at the line of scrimmage, both on the offensive line. I know they've had a lot of first-round draft picks, but they have not been a consistent running team like I'd like to see, especially in 2013, 14, and 15. And then on the defense side of the ball, yes, they've had the elite skill guys coming off the edge in the Miles Garretts, and you know, they even take it back to the Houston, Justin Houston, and a lot of those guys, and obviously Miller. They have not been able to stop the run. I would prefer a guy that really focuses and keys on at the line of scrimmage. That's been what's holding back this program. They just haven't been able to run the football consistently and, more importantly, haven't been able to stop the run.
All right, I'll throw a different name at you then, and then we'll move on from Texas A&M. How about Brent Venables, defensive coordinator from Clemson?
Yeah, I've been waiting for Venables to see what his deal is. He's obviously got Big 12 experience, at least in that region of the country, when he was a longtime coordinator at Oklahoma. Kind of a lot of people waned on him his last couple of years at Oklahoma, was kind of underachieving. You know, the last 4 years, Clemson has been number one in the country every single year in tackles for loss. They have great talent, but they don't have Ohio State, Alabama talent, and they're just turning out great prospects and obviously getting a lot of production. That would be a solid fit. I would project Philip Montgomery would be more the way they go, but, you know, Brad Powers putting the athletic director hat on, I wouldn't mind going more for a defensive guy. I know it doesn't sell the tickets as much, as not as exciting, but I think Venables would be a solid fit there. And we'll see. He's making a lot of money. Maybe he's just happy at Clemson being the number two guy, you know, winning a national championship. He's making, you know, obviously well over $1 million there. Maybe we're just talking about a guy that's a career coordinator. But I would have to think if the SEC head coaching job comes calling, he'd be foolish not to take it.
All right, we'll move away from Texas A&M here. Let's go to the Big Ten. Let's talk about Michigan State, a team that lost a very, very good defensive coordinator in Pat Narduzzi, who went to Pitt. Now all of a sudden, Pitt's playing games where the total is about 75 points per game, which makes absolutely no sense. But things did not go well for Sparty last year in East Lansing. 3-9. The three previous years, they averaged 12 wins per season, so they had 36 wins. They were plus 46 in turnover margin from 2013 to 2015. So is this a situation at Michigan State where we're just running into some variance? Or, you know, is Mike D'Antonio not really getting the talent that he was getting there?
No, you know, number one, what really affected the Harbaugh move to Michigan, you know, everyone talks in the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry. The team that really got impacted by that is Michigan State. They feasted, you know, in-state recruiting and obviously feasted on a down Michigan program. That really hurt them. You know, recruiting has never been – they've been a consistent, you know, top 20 team in recruiting. That really hasn't even been the case. That they're normally right around number 25 to number 30. It's not the talent level, although they lost a multiple-year starting quarterback in Connor Cook. They lost, you know, like a Malik McDowell, you know, some elite players, even in the defensive secondary. I think it was, you know, obviously they were an overachiever. Let's just put it that way. I mean, when you look at their talent level, they should have been more like a 9-win program, not a 12-win program there. So they were a classic overachiever for so many years. I wasn't surprised that they dropped down. I was shocked that they went to 3-9. I didn't think they were capable of falling that far. But obviously, you know, one thing with college football, you know, unlike some of the professional sports, I mean, it's just not on the field that can really impact your team. It's off-field issues. And obviously they got a lot of off-field issues, and they've lost five or six players even since spring practice with, you know, a lot of, you know, serious issues going on that campus as far as, you know, allegations with women with some of the players. That's a major distraction. It can really affect the team. As far as what do I think what Michigan State's future is, are they going to get back to where they were in 2011 through 2015? I don't think so. I mean, somebody's got to lose. When Ohio State's 61-6 under Urban Meyer, when Michigan's back up there winning 10 games every year under Harbaugh, with Penn State's resurgence, not everyone can win 10 or 11 games every single year. I think this team gets back to a bowl this year, but anything more than 6 or 7 wins, I don't see it. I mean, they're one of the least experienced teams in the entire country, only 8 returning starters. They don't have, you know, great talent level at quarterback. Brian Lewerke's all right. I do like a wide receiver. A name to keep out an eye on is Tristan Jackson. He was one of the more impressive players I saw all out of spring. I think he's going to be great. Love their running backs, L.J. Scott, Madre London, Gerald Holmes. I love that. They got a good center. They'll be fine. They'll be back to playing physical style Michigan State football. And even as bad as last year was, they still went into South Bend, Indiana, and put it to Notre Dame. They came within a 2-point conversion of beating Ohio State and then also easily covered the spread against Michigan. I think they'll be back. They'll play with a little bit of an edge, but I just don't see them getting back to that double-digit win season level anytime in the next couple of years, to be honest with you. So I think Michigan State fans need to reset their expectations. And with Mark D'Antonio getting up there in age, I mean, this is his 11th year. It's going to be tough. I mean, recruiting is a lot of energy, and right now they don't have a lot of momentum going on there in East Lansing.
Yeah, I got to correct myself there. Head coach Mark D'Antonio, as you mentioned, one of the things that really stands out to me, look at 2013. They were plus 15 in sacks, 2014 plus 31 in sacks, 2015 plus 16 in sacks. Last year, they were minus 16 in sacks. They only had 11 sacks as a defense. Is this a Pat Narduzzi thing? Is this a talent thing? You know, as you've deep dived into this team over the last couple of years, can you figure this thing out?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say it's a Pat Narduzzi thing, but like you said, I mean, Pat Narduzzi struggled big time on defensive side of the ball in his next job. I mean, if he had Pitt up there like his offense was last year, then I'd say, yeah, that'd be easy. I don't think it's necessarily a talent. I mean, they had an All-American in McDowell last year who just didn't live up, just like the rest of the team. They really didn't live up to expectations. I think this year will be more of a telltale story. I thought they had a fluky 12-win season in 2015. I thought they were very fortunate to get to the college football playoff. You know, statistically, they only outscored their opponents by 8 points per game. I think they just relied heavily on a veteran quarterback and Connor Cook to get them in the right place. I mean, the more dominant teams were the 2013 team that went to the Rose Bowl and really a dominant team in 2014 when they outscored their opponents by 22 points per game and they ended up winning the Cotton Bowl. Yeah, I thought the regression already started in 2015, just didn't show up in the record. You know, we'll see if it's schematically, if it's a talent thing. We'll know a little bit more this year. I think it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, you don't lose one of the better defensive coordinators in the country and not expect – to have a little bit of, you know, a downfall, and it's not like you replaced them, and Michigan State doesn't have the payroll like a Michigan or Ohio State has where they can just put another hotshot assistant in there and pay them seven figures. That wasn't the case there at Michigan State. And then, like I said, I mean, the talent level's never been there, and if you have a couple of four-year starters that are gone and that pipeline in the defensive secondary is just not there, and, you know, they've lost four or five guys out of the secondary even since spring practice, it's a combination of both, but we'll see. I'm not going to doubt Mark D'Antonio. I mean, he's gotten a hell of a lot out of this program, just about more than any other coach in the history of the program. This will be a big year, and I think obviously the big key game for them, they open up Bowling Green, Western Michigan, should get two wins there. By then, they host Notre Dame and Iowa. If they can get if they can avoid the noise outside the program, really focus in on it, I would not be stunned if they started 4-0. If they're 4-0, then I think they can, you know, definitely put the 2016 season in the rearview mirror.
All right, let's talk about a team that doesn't really have a question with talent, and that's UCLA. You know, they have one of the top quarterbacks in the country in Josh Rosen, who, you know, has made headlines here over the last couple of days once again. But this is a team that, you know, they've been really hampered by the injury bug. That is something I can give Jim Mora Jr. a little bit of a pass for, that injuries have absolutely crippled this team over the last few years. Now, that being said, you're UCLA. You are a program that recruits itself. What kid out there on the West Coast doesn't want to play for USC or UCLA? So Mora's had a significant amount of talent, and their records have been decent, but, I mean, this is a team a few years ago that people were talking about to win the national championship, didn't come anywhere close. Last year, they went 4-8. So how do you possibly try to rate a team like UCLA with all this talent? But, you know, we just talked about a chronic overachiever in Michigan State. This is a chronic underachiever now at UCLA.
Yeah, it's an underachiever, although I don't know if it's necessarily Jim Mora. They're a chronic underachiever as a program. I mean, when have they really, you know, taken the world by storm? I mean, they had back-to-back Rose Bowls in 97-98 where they won 20 games with Cade McNown. Terry Donahue was a decent head coach there, but again, Troy Aikman had a couple of good years there as a starting quarterback, but when has UCLA ever been a consistent top 10 program? I mean, they're second in their own city, and if USC's got things rolling, I'm sorry to say, but USC's going to get the pick of the talent there in the city of LA and the state of California if they're rolling, and the problem is USC, after at the end of last season, is rolling once again. And that's going to be a big problem for the future recruiting classes for UCLA. I thought he did a solid job his first three seasons, 9 games, 10 wins, 10 wins. I mean, he inherited a program that had top 7 wins in any of the previous 5 seasons. So he did a good job the first three seasons. You're right, the injuries have really taken a toll on him, particularly last year. I know it was a very disappointing season, but it's not like they were playing really bad football. I mean, they lost in overtime on the road to Texas A&M. That wasn't bad there. They were able to beat BYU in a game that was much closer than the final indicated. BYU scored a couple of touchdowns late. Stanford was a misleading 9-point loss. Stanford scored 2 touchdowns in the final 30 seconds, one of the worst beats of the entire year for anyone that had UCLA +3 or 3.5 in that one. Crushed Arizona, and then all of a sudden in the Arizona State game, their quarterback goes out, Josh Rosen, and they only won one more game the rest of the year, so it was perfectly understandable. Maybe not 4-8, but I get why they took a major step back, and then the defense also had some injuries. No excuses this year, though, with 15 returning starters. Rosen making a lot of news. I mean, if one area that they have got what was completely disappointing and it completely inexcusable last year is the fact that UCLA had the second worst rush offense in the entire country, only averaged 84 yards per game rushing the football. That's inexcusable. I don't care who's at quarterback, who's on the offensive line. That has got to get better, and get better by meaning double the production this year if they're going to start to live up to some expectations. Even though the defense is a little bit less experienced than what they were last year, I think a lot of guys, because of all the injuries last year, are a little bit more experienced than you think. I do have a UCLA ticket. CGT came out with 6 wins for them early. I think the season win total is 6.5, 7 a lot of places now. I jumped on the over. But it's not an easy schedule by any stretch of the imagination. And it starts with the opener against Texas A&M. I'll be rooting for UCLA at least to win that game. I don't have a bet individually on that one. I think the 3.5 point spread's about right. They have a very tricky game at Memphis. That could be a loss there. At Stanford, they're at Washington, they're at Utah, they're at USC. So I get why the season win total was a little bit low, but I think if they can get some confidence, beat Texas A&M in that opener, this is a team on talent level is the second best team, no question, the Pac-12 South behind USC. But are they going to jump back up to 10 wins this year, Adam? If you're looking at Mora and saying, hey, man, he's got to get back to 9 wins, you know, even though I got that season win total ticket on them, I'm thinking it's more 7-5, 8-4 for UCLA. A top 5 schedule in terms of difficulty is going to, you know, kind of prevent them from making a huge jump up in the standings this year.
Third offensive coordinator in 3 years at UCLA. This time it's Jed Fish, who was at Michigan the last 2 years there with Jim Harbaugh. What does that do for you from a power rating standpoint in terms of, you know, now the offense has to learn an entirely different set of schemes for the third straight year? And they do have a lot of upperclassmen in this offense, 9 returning starters. Does that show up in your power ratings?
It's not ideal, obviously. I do take it down slightly. The fact that they have a revolving door, you know, they made a major schematic change last year. Did not, they were going from tempo to more of a pro style. You know, Jed Fish has more, you know, is more of a pro style type of coach coming from Harbaugh's experience there. And Jim Mora is more of a pro style type of coach. So I think they'll move back to a little bit more tempo like they had early on in Jim Mora's career. But I don't think it's necessarily, you know, a big step like what they had last year, where they just totally threw out what they had been doing in the previous 4 years and went in an entirely different direction. It can't get much worse from an offensive aspect than what they were a year ago. And I think Jed Fish is going to look pretty smart just for the fact that Josh Rosen can stay healthy. I think I would not be stunned if UCLA's offense probably improves by about a touchdown per game, and really none of it has to do with the particular schemes, Adam.
Well, let's stay here in the Pac-12 South. Let's talk Colorado. Colorado and Mike McIntyre's first 3 years won 10 games combined. Last year, they won 10 games. They were 10-4, went to the Alamo Bowl, got decimated by Oklahoma State in that game. But still, it was a great season there in Boulder. And now we've got a lot of questions because this defense has been torn apart by losses to the NFL draft, guys that have run out of eligibility. They only have 3 returning starters on defense. However, on offense, they have 9 of them. And a lot of people think Steven Montez is probably a better quarterback than Sefo Lufau for this offense. So Colorado is a team I'm very excited to follow this season. I was very excited to look through and try to power rate them. Was it a difficult team to rate for you?
No, they were one of the first teams to finish up spring practice, so I really dived into them because they finished up in early March, and it was you know, fun to look at some college football at that particular time with March Madness going on. You know, I do have a Colorado ticket. I went with under 7.5 as far as their season win total. I think it's a program that obviously had a very big outlier season. I like Mike McIntyre. But I have way too many questions on the defense side of the ball. And that's where they've made the major step. They've been relatively decent on offense, you know, in his tenure there. It's been the defense that was issues in 2013. And what happened in 2015, He made an outstanding hire with getting Jim Leavitt as a defense corner. Massive improvements that first year. And they took another massive step last year. Well, Jim Leavitt's at Oregon right now, and most of those key players off of last year's team are gone. I'm not liking a lot of the replacements. I do like their nose guard, Javier Edwards. He was a guy that stood out to me in spring practice. And they've lost a couple of guys here in fall camp, and they do have a key starting cornerback that also is suspended right now. Not liking the Buffalo's defense. In fact, you know, if I had to power rate them, I would not be stunned if they gave up about a touchdown more per game this year than what they did last year, allowing 21.7. But the thing I do like about Colorado this year, you mentioned it, 9 returning starters on offense. I agree with you. I think Steven Montez has more upside than Sifo Lufau. That's saying a lot because Lufau is the all-time career passing leader in Colorado history. I don't know if he's out of the gate and just as good as Lufau, but I think by the end of the season he will be. They got an underrated running back in Philip Lindsay. He's a little undersized at 5'8", 190, but a ton of production out of him. I love their wide receiver core. I would put it in the top 5 in the country. Everyone's back from last year. I love that talent there. Offensive line's better than what they were. I have an under 7.5 season win total. A lot of it goes to schedule, I think. I know a lot of people are going to say, hey, they get key games against Washington and USC at home. I'm telling you, even though those are at home, those teams are clearly far superior to Colorado, and I think they're double-digit home underdogs in both of those games. They're at UCLA, and I think they're an underdog there, at Washington State, at Arizona State, at Utah. Tough schedule for them. They'll probably get out to a 3-0 start. They're not going back to where they were for so many years this decade, where they're a 2-3-win type of team. But I think they do take a step back this year, and they go to maybe 6 and hopefully 7 wins so I can cash that season win total. But I think most importantly, you're looking for value with a much improved offense probably and a team that's probably going to have to outscore their opponents and obviously a defense that I think is going to take multiple steps back. Let's see the value in Colorado games on a total individual game basis as far as the totals go, because I believe last year they were like 10-4 to the under. If I can get a lot of Colorado games in the 50s, I'm going to have a lot of over tickets, at least early on. I think they're going to feature a lot of high-scoring games this year.
I've got Colorado power rated 7th here in the Pac-12. Where do you put them?
Let me look. I know I got them right around 35th in the country. Going down, I have them 7th behind USC, Washington, Stanford, Oregon, Washington State, and behind UCLA. Just slightly above Utah. I'm not a big fan of Utah this year, particularly at the line of scrimmage. So, well, I'll tell you, Adam, I always knew you were a very wise individual, but that's exactly where I would place Colorado as far as power ratings go.
Yeah, and I've got Colorado 33rd in my 1 through 130, so we're pretty much right on the same track there. And that's interesting to me because – you know, I look at a team like Colorado and I kind of wondered to myself, okay, Mike McIntyre got this thing going in the right direction. And look, he inherited nothing with this team. They were 1-11 when he took over. And in fact, in McIntyre's second year, they were 2-10. So I think what's really interesting to look at with a team like this is, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit with some other teams on previous shows this week, is you've got a team now that has experienced success for the first time in a long time. I mean, they hadn't made a bowl game since 2007. So you kind of wonder, is it the culture of the program changing? Is it an outlier? That was the word that you used earlier in the segment here. I'll be very, very fascinated to watch Colorado here this season. And also, like you said, their games could be pretty damn exciting because we could see some very high-scoring affairs.
Yeah, and look, by outlier, extreme outlier, 10 wins. He's got them. They're going to be a bowl type of team. I think he's got the talent level and everything except for they're going to bowls, but – I mean, they didn't handle it last year. Look, they had the exciting regular season, 10-2. They didn't handle it as far as the Pac-12 title game and the bowl game too well. They were crushed in both of those. And they talked about them having a great season in spring, but they didn't finish it off like they wanted to. That's still a concern and a question mark for me. How do they handle now expectations? It's easy to come up and surprise everyone, but when you got the bullseye and the target on your backs now for the first time, it's going to be interesting to see how they handle it because they didn't handle it well at the end of last season.
So I mentioned where you and I have Colorado rated, and I know that you've got a big network out there. And, of course, you know, you like to compare with some of the other power rating systems that are out there. does it feel like we're kind of in the general consensus about Colorado, or does it seem like people are maybe a little bit higher, a little bit lower than we are?
I think we're, you know, we haven't seen too much movement on their season win total. I'm not the only one that has the under there as far as that one. And I think, you know, I got an early 7.5. I think South Point opened them up at 7. Other places have them at 7, 7.5. I haven't seen too much movement. Where we did see a tremendous amount of movement, I think Chris Andrews was much higher on Colorado than everyone else, because he had them favored in October 21st game at Washington State, back-to-back road trips for Colorado. He had them favored in that game, and that's been one of the biggest line movements in the game of the year lines. That's moved like 7 or 8 points, where now Washington State is about a touchdown favorite there. He was much higher than the rest of the market. I wish I'd have had a lot of tickets on that one. That was not a good line there. I think a lot of people pounced on that one, Washington State probably being a little bit higher rated than Chris Andrews had him. But I think definitely Colorado, everyone else at least that was betting that particular day right around Memorial Day weekend, a lot of people were down farther down and had downgraded Colorado than what Chris Andrews did. I think we're pretty much in line where the rest of the market is, having them in the 30 range as far as Colorado this season.
One more team I want to talk about here from a college football standpoint, and then we'll get into a little bit of NFL stuff here with the preseason, in my opinion, kicking off last night, because I don't really include the Hall of Fame game too much. But I want to talk about Boise State. You know, Boise State for a long time has been the class of the Group of Five programs. And you know, this is a situation at Boise State where, you know, they get a lot of good talent. Chris Peterson is no longer there. Brian Harsin's been the head coach for the last 3 years. You kind of have to wonder if things start to fall off a little bit at Boise State. Last year, 0-6 against the number at home. They still wound up winning 10 games, but they didn't feel like the same type of Boise State team that we've seen over the last few years. Is that just a perception bias, or is this a team trending in the wrong direction?
Yeah, they're not. Look, they're coming off a program high there under Chris Peterson, and they actually disappointed his last season, only winning 8 games. So the fall off actually began probably the season before. You know, Harsin did do a good job, and they won the Fiesta Bowl in 2014. So you really made it as a program if you're winning a Fiesta Bowl as a Group of Five team. You win 9 games, you win 10 games, and everyone's saying, boy, what's wrong with Boise State? They're not anywhere near what they were, some of them Kellen Moore type of teams. And this year's talent level is not overwhelming. They lose a great back in Jeremy McNichols. They only have 9 returning starters. They lose their leading receiver. I agree with you. Last year was a disappointment. Although, you know, they had started the season, I believe, 7-0, and really the downfall kind of happened at Wyoming, where they lost that one and then really had the disappointing finish, losing to both Air Force and then did not have a good bowl game against a Baylor team. Still, it was 10 wins. And look, I get it that everyone – I'm reading so many articles, the blue turf, not big of an advantage anymore. I get that they're 0-6 against the spread at home. Well, when you're laying like 11 points to a 9-win Washington State team, I just think the market, you know, took way too much respect for the blue turf. It's still one of the better home field advantages. I mean, when you're laying 4 touchdowns in every game, it's tough to cover spreads. I don't care if you're Alabama or Ohio State in that regard. I thought that, you know, people are probably a little bit down on Boise State more than I am. I could tell you in the markets were when they opened up, what, -5 or -6 against Troy. One of my first week one max bets is on Boise State in week one at that number, and obviously they're laying 12 now. I thought people were a little bit too down on them. I mean, this was still heading into the final game of the regular season, a team that was 10-1 with a win over Washington State, and they're only lost by 2 points last year. I think there's been a little bit of an overreaction to this whole downfall. They're not as good as the Fiesta Bowl teams, but I still think, you know, them and San Diego State, and maybe to a lesser extent Colorado State for this year, are still easily the class of that conference. And when you got a 3-year starting quarterback in Brett Rippon, I think they're going to be in decent shape this year. And their season win total is only 8. It is a tougher schedule, particularly for a Mountain West team, but I'm not buying this whole, you know, Boise State's really going down and going in a really bad direction.
Yeah, actually, I had that number for the Troy-Boise State game in the 8, 8.5 range. And with the movement that's happened in that game, obviously it makes me want to take a second look at both of those teams and probably Boise State more so than Troy. Because I feel like given what I have for the Sun Belt lines with Troy games, I think I'm in pretty good shape there. But maybe I am a little bit low on Boise State. And maybe I'm a little bit low on Brian Harsin. And maybe I'm concerned that now that we're looking solely at Harsin recruits as opposed to Peterson recruits, you know, this is a program that could fall off the pace a little bit. And I guess another sort of side element to this is when you try to rate a team like Boise State, you know, you look at what's going on at Colorado State, you look at all the hype surrounding Wyoming with Josh Allen at quarterback. Is that a contributing factor too, where maybe we're kind of overrating what the rest of the division is doing around Boise State?
Yeah, and look, they've had a little bit of struggle since they moved to the Mountain West. This ain't the WAC. You know, the Mountain West, you know, not a overwhelmingly great conference, but, you know, they're not playing New Mexico State and, you know, Idaho like they were when they were killing everybody under Chris Peterson for so many years. I mean, look, the San Diego State's a very physical, a very good team. Ask their opponents in their last two bowl games, Cincinnati and Houston, how good San Diego State is. You know, Colorado State's obviously taking a next step, and I think that's a program I would buy, particularly with an outstanding new stadium. New Mexico, Bob Davies been better. Now, I will say this. Their division's much tougher than the Mountain Division's a lot tougher than the West Division, particularly this year. It's San Diego State and everybody else in the West, and it's San Diego State by a large margin. Some of it's, you know, the Mountain West has gotten a little bit stronger. Some of it's Boise State getting a little bit weaker. But, you know, if you're asking, is it a question of talent? I don't think so. I mean, Boise State's still out recruiting by far the rest of the league. So, you know, I think, look, is Brian Harsin as good as Chris Peterson? No. I mean, not everyone can beat Chris Peterson. Chris Peterson might be a top five coach in the country right now. You saw the job that he did at Washington last year. You know, Brian Harsin can still be a good coach. He's just not in, you know, Chris Peterson's league. And that's all right. I mean, as long as he's continuing to win, you know, 10 games a year and maybe has that once every 5 years, they're going to a bit, they're grabbing that group of five spot and they're going to a major bowl game. That's all right. I mean, I swear, the fans, everyone's got the instant gratification mentality. Winning 10 games a year in college football today, it's hard. And just because you're a spoiled and you're winning 12, 13 games every year, I get it. It's a little bit of a step back. But, I mean, people got to check their role a little bit. They're playing in a little bit of a tougher conference, and they don't have one of the best coaches in college football walking the sidelines. If they fall to 7 wins or something this year, then I would be very concerned. But if they're winning 9, 10 games again, I'm not that concerned with the overall state of the Boise State football program.
All right, let's transition over to the professionals here for a few minutes, talk some NFL, and let's start with season setup. Do you do power ratings for the NFL?
I do power ratings. Do I consider them anywhere near like I do? Do I agonize over them like my college football power ratings? Absolutely not. I mean, let's just be realistic. I mean, how far can you be off on an NFL team as far as a power rating? I mean, sometimes you can find some value. You know, maybe I have a couple of power ratings plays per year, but a lot of it would have to go into the fact that just individual game-by-game basis, maybe a team's just much better than their record because they're minus 4 turnovers consecutive weeks, and they're losing games because of that. Do not put any – they're really not even – I get it that they should be a starting off point for, you know, any particular game. They are definitely in college football, and that is where I immediately start isolating my games and what I'll like on an individual week-by-week basis. The NFL, I don't start with my power ratings so much. I start with what – here's what I start with the NFL when I'm – at least in the regular season. I'm always looking for clear overreaction to what I just saw on Sunday because everybody else does it, and if it's not for a key injury – or something drastic like that. We see so much overreaction. It's such a parity-driven league. I get it. New England's the top of the top. The Browns are the worst of the worst. But outside of that, you just don't see much of a difference between the rest of the 30 teams in the league. So yeah, I'm very simple. I wish I could, you know, come out here and have, you know, talk advanced analytics and all that when it comes to the NFL. I'm very simple when I'm handicapping it. Looking for overreaction, playing against that, teams that I perceive to be overvalued and undervalued. And believe it or not, I've actually, in the last couple of years, probably had even slightly more success in the NFL It drives me a little crazy, to be honest with you, Adam, because I probably spend 5 to 6 times as much time on college as I do the NFL, but yet the success rate is still right there with college, and even in some instances even better in the NFL than it is in college.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we talked at the absolute top of this segment here, I don't know, it feels like 3 hours ago, but it was just about an hour ago, about, you know, having those college football power ratings put together for so long, and then sitting there and you know, having the willpower not to overanalyze them, not to tweak them too much. The NFL, I mean, it's a very tight market, and we all understand that. And I think subconsciously we kind of overcomplicate the NFL, where, you know, I know that you like to talk about the NFL, less is more, simplifying what you do. It's kind of one of those things where if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, well, it must be a duck. And the NFL sort of feels like that. Whereas with college, you know, like you said, I mean, the power ratings mean so much more. There's so much more variance just because of the nature of the sport, where you've got bigger spreads. Maybe it feels like a lot of us do overcomplicate the NFL.
I think so. I know handicappers do. I you know, when I'm sitting in there, we talk about those meetings that we've have on Tuesday with a lot of it. I think a lot of them are in the same boat. I mean, at least in the majority of those meetings, most of them, over half, are college guys first. Some, I think, to take the NFL a little bit too much. At least that's my, you know, personal experience when it comes to the NFL. I come from, you know, I you know, was obviously raised up in the North Coast thing. And while we put, you know, time into the NFL, college was first and foremost. That's how I've been as a human being since, you know, since I could walk and watch football. It's always been college first and foremost. And look, sometimes my struggle with college is I probably – should simplify things, and yet I'm always constantly tweaking that. NFL to me is, until I have a horrible losing season, and I'm not sitting there, and I've had back-to-back winning seasons, until I have that season where I really got to take a long, hard look. North Coast taught me how to handicap it. It's worked for them for so many years. They have a lot of years have had better success rates in the NFL than college. I've had that the first couple of years. If it's not broke, don't fix it. I'm not going to spend any more time than what I've had to the last couple of years as far as the NFL goes. But I think a lot of people, I think, and some of it might even, you know, this is just me speculating, since everyone is in the fantasy football leagues and everybody's digesting individual players, I think people do spend a little bit more time than what they should be in complicating what the NFL is all about. When it's a parity-driven league, just look for, you know, examples. You know, the Oakland Raiders last year, look, I bet against them a lot. Last year I had a losing season betting against the Oakland Raiders, but I can tell you this, if I could give any advice to anyone in the NFL for the next 5 years, I can see it by just looking at the general public betting on the Raiders. You will make money betting against the Raiders, even though I think they're going to be one of the better organizations and franchises in the National Football League as long as they keep Derek Carr. There is going to be clear point spread inflation on them just from this local market. And if you're betting the local casinos that really take in a lot of the locals, you can make money. And I'm not going to, you know, try to, you know, examine how good Oakland is on advanced metrics and all that. I'm just going to bet against the public. And a lot of times I do that simply in the NFL. It's the most bet sport there is. The public loses more than it wins. A lot of times I like being on the other side in the NFL. So I just got a couple of general philosophies. I'm going to roll with it. And I know it's not a great soundbite for your audience when it comes to the NFL, but to me, that's just how I think anyone out there that's doing anything more than that is, I don't want to say you're wasting your time, but in some instances, you kind of are.
So we've got the NFL preseason going on. As I mentioned, last night we had Houston and Carolina. What do you do in terms of the NFL preseason? Do you have some betting strategies for that? Do you touch it? Do you use that to, you know, as a springboard for your NFL season setup? How do you take the preseason?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not as valuable as what it was probably 20 years ago. It's a lot sharper market. Saw that first game was a push and almost a push on time total, even on the Hall of Fame game. The information's out there to be had. I'm not going to be breaking news here. You're looking at the quarterback rotations. You can say, you know, at least perceive there to be value on certain quarterback rotations. I'll probably like Arizona's when you look and see what Gabbert did. And if he's your third-string quarterback, I mean, I think Arizona and maybe a game three situation would be a team that I'd really like to look for just because of their superior quarterback rotations. Hey, what's the coach's history in the preseason? Does he care about winning preseason games? Again, not breaking news with that. It's out there for everyone to be had. There are clear coaches that value the preseason. Your John Harbaughs, when he's 24-12 straight up, 23-13 against the spread, that's long-term, you know, results there for Baltimore, and they're 4-0 last year. You got guys that don't value the preseason, or they're at a, you know, talent disadvantage. You know, I think Hugh Jackson, you know, cares a little bit more than his 0-8 straight up and 0-8 against the spread record, but a lot of times he's just been at a talent disadvantage there with his year at Oakland, and then obviously the year last year at Cleveland. I'm just looking for coaches that care. Obviously, I think Pete Carroll really cared at the start, and they had a really good roster compared to everybody else. I think there was clear point spread inflation from them for the last couple of years, so you got to take that in consideration. And then, you know, Mike Zimmer's out there. We'll see how Minnesota does this year, but Mike Zimmer's been Mr. Preseason, 12-1 straight up and 11-2 against the spread, and he's not afraid to blitz. That's another thing you want to look for, coaches that like to bring some pressures, because you can have some mix of some bad matchups on the offensive line if you're bringing some pressures. That can be automatic wins in that regard. Nothing major. Quarterback rotations, you know, are they caring? And that's pretty much it. And whether or not I perceive there to be some value, Adam. But it's nothing. I don't let the NFL preseason affect my bankroll too much, whether it be positive or negative. The last thing I want to do is, you know, go, you know, have 10 preseason plays and go 2-8 and everyone's already upset and at a major disadvantage heading into the season. You never want that. That's Brad Powers, the handicapper. Brad Powers, the better, might be a little bit more aggressive when it comes to preseason if I really perceive there to be some value.
Another guy that kind of fits that mold is Mike Tomlin with Pittsburgh. You know, Tomlin is a guy that at the outset, just he was a very good bet in the preseason, and now that he's got an established team, an aging quarterback, there's a lot less emphasis on the preseason for him. So, you know, coaches kind of hit the ground like their head's on fire and, you know, want to go out there and win games and change the culture and all this type of stuff. And then as they do it a little bit more, they realize, okay, well, you know, we're a pretty good team now. So now we just focus on these little details, these little specific areas. So I definitely think that coaching is certainly the best way to attack the NFL preseason there. But Brad Powers from BradPowersSports.com, we'll have him on every Thursday here throughout the season. What's going on over at the website right now, man?
Yeah, at the website right now, you can download. I got 4 free issues up there that got you covered all ways, including the NFL preseason. I mean, if you want to take a look at what teams have done the last 4 or 5 years, all the preseason records are up there as far as individual teams. They're up there as far as preseason records by head coach. You just need a simple, you know, quarterback rotation. The depth charts, you know, going 4 strings back for every single team, that's there. Rotation schedules. You know, I put my team-by-team draft grade reports up there for all NFL. It's a great issue. It's up there right now for free. If you're a college guy like me, I also check out that college football summer betting guide where you can see, and I'm not afraid to post all my tickets that I have as far as the betting tickets early on in the markets. We'll have another issue coming out next week. Make sure you're following me on Twitter, @BradPowers7. We're going to really dive into some specifics as far as college football and a conference level, season win total projections for every team. I'll have the Sun Belt up if you're listening on Thursday. If you're listening later this weekend, I'll have the Conference USA and the MAC up, individual team write-ups for every single team, season win total projections. Always make sure you're following me on Twitter, @BradPowers7, and also check out the Powers Picks newsletter, $79 for the whole season right now. Every single game write-up on every single college game and NFL game, it's emailed to you weekly, top picks of the week. I think it's a great – it's $79. It's a great investment. You spend that out on a dinner out with the family. If you just want to follow it as far as the betting market, it's not a bad little read. And, look, I went to school for writing. It's not a bad read, to be honest with you, Adam. So check that all out, BradPowersSports.com. Follow me on Twitter, @BradPowers7.
Brad, as always, a real treat, man. Looking forward to this football and basketball season with you. Thank you so much for joining me, man. I'll talk to you again next week.
Hey, sounds great, man. Take care. It was always a pleasure, and congrats again, bud.
Thank you so much, man. Brad Powers from BradPowersSports.com. So, obviously, like I said, since I'm getting married tomorrow, we won't be doing a show on Friday. I apologize. It's one of the few days off I will take here during 2017. But we'll be back on the air once again on Monday. We'll chat with Joe Everett of NFL Draft Bible with what will during the season be called our NFL Week in Review and Monday Night Football Preview, but we'll preview some teams here coming up this season. It's pretty similar to what we talked about here on last Monday's segment with him. Then also our college football first look with Kyle Hunter of huntersportspicks.com. We'll chat, obviously, college football, as the name implies, but we'll also look at some NFL stuff as well as we get into the second week of the preseason. But that'll do it for me. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Have a happy, smart, safe weekend, and I will talk to you again on Monday.